The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The Biden administration wants to speed up the asylum process, but collecting all the documents to do that can be a real challenge for applicants.
Some of them are walking around with birth certificates that are frayed because in some of these countries, it is impossible to keep getting new birth certificates.
Also today, Puerto Rico's public utility is privatized. It was scorned after Hurricane Maria, but it was once seen with pride.
As the model that was followed in the island to electrify even the most remote parts of our countryside.
We also take a fresh look at the Titanic disaster from a Chinese perspective and hear about a new NBA power broker with some crazy ideas for his team.
They make court out of glass. It is see-through, so we sit more people underneath the court.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us this Friday. In Peru, voters are heading to the polls on Sunday to choose a new president. This will be Peru's fifth president in 5 years. Remember, the country is also reeling from the COVID crisis. Peru has the highest coronavirus mortality rate on Earth. The economic impact of the pandemic has also been large, and as we've seen in many places, it is the poorest communities that have been hit the hardest. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia reports from one mountainside community in the capital, Lima, where neighbors are figuring out ways to keep each other fed.
The neighbors leading these efforts are mostly mothers, like Josie Campos Diaz.
Tengo tres. Eduard, la segunda se llama Angela, y la última se llama Valeria.
Campos Diaz has three kids, she says. Eduard is 16, Angela is 10, and Galeria is 7. They live in a house made with plywood and corrugated zinc tiles. And at the beginning of the pandemic, Campos Diaz's husband lost his job as a plumber, and the family immediately ran out of money.
Mis hijos decían, mamá, compra pan, no tenía ni para comprar pan. Queremos tomar leche, no había ni para tomar leche.
Sometimes the kids would ask for bread, and I didn't have money for bread, Campos Diaz says. They wanted milk, and I couldn't buy milk. Campos Diaz started talking with her neighbors and realized they didn't have a single coin in their pocket either. So they decided to look for what they did have.
Buscamos ollas, ¿no? Sabes que yo tengo olla, yo tengo cucharón, yo tengo sartén, entonces a poner, ¿no?
Someone had a pot, someone else had a pan, another person had a ladle, she says. And so that's how they created what they called an olla comunitaria, or community pot.
Somos familias, somos 36 familias. Porciones son 108.
The community pot serves 36 families and 108 meals every day, Campos Diaz says. All with food that Campos Diaz goes and asks for in markets and other parts of the city. Neighborhood moms take turns cooking in front of Campos Diaz's house. She says their neighborhood is not the only one that relies on a community pot.
Claro que todavía María lo necesita, pero hay otras familias que más están pasando momentos difíciles.
The entire mountainside district where Campos Diaz lives relies on community pots, she says. The higher up you go on the hill, the worse things are, she explains. And she lives only about halfway. Employment levels in Lima have completely crashed during the pandemic, explains Javier Portocarrero Maish of the Social and Economic Research Consortium of Peru. The country's economy contracted by 11%, making it one of the hardest hit countries in Latin America. And people in the most vulnerable situations were the first and most affected.
Como el Perú es un país que 73% de la población es informal.
Portocarrero Maish explains that almost 3/4 of Peru's workforce is employed informally, and they collectively earn only 1/5 of the country's gross domestic product. And so the economy is a major factor in this Sunday's election, Portocarrero Maish says. And the leftist economic platform of candidate Pedro Castillo may appeal to millions of desperate voters.
Normalmente, en el Perú, digamos que un partido comunista pueda ganar una elección es algo muy improbable, pero por la pandemia sí lo es.
Normally, it would be improbable for a communist party to win in Peru, but the pandemic has changed that, Portocarrero Maish says. Plus, there's a strong sentiment against candidate Keiko Fujimori, a former congresswoman whose father is a former president accused of authoritarianism and convicted of corruption charges. Back at the home of Josie Campos Diaz, she says that it's a secret who she'll vote for. But she does say she hopes whoever wins will remember the struggles that she and her neighbors are facing. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Lima, Peru.
Yesterday, Denmark's parliament passed a law making big changes to the country's asylum policies. Refugees seeking asylum will now be flown outside of Denmark while their applications are processed. The mechanics of the law, including where applications could be processed, have yet to be worked out. Eva Singer directs the asylum department of the Danish Refugee Council. What is your understanding, Eva, of how this law would actually function?
Well, actually, at the moment, it won't function at all. Because, as you just mentioned, there is no agreement with a third country to receive the asylum seekers who are coming to Denmark.
Right, that third country is still being sought out. What is the government's rationale behind this, though, in Copenhagen? Why did they pass the law now?
Well, there are various explanations given. Originally, the government was trying to maintain that this is more humanitarian, because then asylum seekers and refugees do not have to cross the Mediterranean, which is very risky, obviously. They do not have to pay human smugglers to enter Europe to seek asylum. But this is obviously not the main reason, because anybody who wants to avail of this possibility, they still have to come to Denmark to seek asylum before being removed to a third country. So I think what is more clear from the statements coming from the government and from politicians is that this is part of the government's plan that Denmark should not receive any asylum seekers at all. So it should act as a deterrent for asylum seekers not to come to Denmark, but actually go to other countries if they are in need of protection.
Why does your organization, the Danish Refugee Council, object to this law?
Firstly, we are certain that there's a huge risk to the individuals concerned. If they come to Denmark, there will be a big risk that they will be detained while here. Then if they are to be removed to the third country, it's unavoidable, I think, that there would be a use of force to do so. And then once they get to this other country, it is very difficult to see that Denmark can guarantee their human rights. It's very difficult to see that Denmark can guarantee that they will get a proper asylum case handling, and that if they're recognized as refugees, that they will be given the rights which they are entitled to as refugees.
As you said earlier, Eva, no third country has been chosen yet. What countries are being considered, and how far along is that process?
The process is kept very secret. What we know from the newspapers is that the government has had discussions with quite a number of countries in North Africa, in Rwanda as well. What we know from what the minister says is that he is now narrowing the numbers down to maybe a handful that he will continue his discussions with over the next year or so.
And do we have any sense of like what kind of accommodations these people would be offered in these third countries? Is that clear?
Not at all. All the details about how the procedure will be, how the accommodation, the schools, health systems, all of this has been left aside. We are told that that will only be discussed once the government has an agreement with a third country. So you could say that the law, which was passed yesterday, was in a way an empty shell, because most of the most important areas of the model remains to be seen.
It occurs to me that these third countries, if there is one chosen, could end up caught in a controversial situation. What would they get out of this?
Well, the government has said that they will be looking at financial assistance. They will be looking at visa requirements, for example, for students, and other forms of beneficial treatment. So this is also not very concrete at the moment.
How does this new law square with EU rules about asylum seekers, Eva? I mean, the EU's executive commission has already expressed concern about this.
Normal EU law, this is not possible, because under normal EU law, the countries have an obligation to deal with the asylum cases on their own territory.
But here it becomes a bit tricky because although we are part of the EU, Denmark has reservations in some areas, including in the area of asylum and migration. So some of the EU legislation relating to this specifically, Denmark is not bound by. But it's problematic if in the long run, the Danish proposal and the Danish way of doing refugee protection will cause other countries to follow. We have seen the UK having similar ideas, and obviously the UK are not bound by the EU legislation either.
Eva Singer directs the Asylum Department of the Danish Refugee Council. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
This weekend, Mexicans are heading to the polls for one of that country's most significant elections in recent memory. And for the first time, a new official will be elected by people not living in Mexico. Mexican expats will elect somebody to represent them from a distance. The World's Daisy Contreras has our story.
For the last few months, candidates turned to social media like Twitter, Facebook, and Zoom to debate.
Soy Raúl Torres, tu candidato del PAN.
Raúl Torres is running with the National Action Party, one of Mexico's big political parties.
Para ellos busco el crear el fondo para el migrante en retorno.
He says he wants to create a program that funds the safe return of Mexican immigrants deported from other countries. Then it's candidate Andrea Catcanto's turn. She's with the Institutional Revolutionary Party.
La mujer migrante sufre muchos problemas en el extranjero.
She wants to help Mexican women living abroad who experience gender violence. In all, 11 contenders are running for a seat in Mexico. In Mexico City, actually. It's called the Migrant Council seat. It's new and is set up to represent people from Mexico City living abroad. Most of the candidates are women. Most have also lived outside of Mexico. This is historic, says Mauricio Huesca. He's with the Electoral Institute of Mexico City, which oversees elections.
Van a traer al debate público y parlamentario temas y problemáticas que nunca antes habíamos visto en la agenda pública de nuestra ciudad.
Whoever is elected will be expected to bring up issues that Mexico City hasn't tackled before, says Huesca. Issues important to Mexicans living abroad, like visa processing or how U.S. employers treat migrants. The new representative can lobby for change, just like other elected officials. But there's skepticism, too. Some politicians and people living in Mexico argue that if someone's left the country, they shouldn't have a direct representative. Huesca disagrees.
El hecho de que se vayan a radicar fuera no implica que tengan un abandono de los asuntos políticos.
The fact that people have left doesn't mean they've abandoned their political interests, Huesca says. For too long, he says, Mexicans living abroad have been left out. Fabi Taub is someone who welcomes having more of a say. She and her husband have lived in southern Germany for 10 years. This is Taub's first time voting in a Mexican election.
Creo que son tiempos muy difíciles para el país y como una ciudadana extranjera, es súper importante que también se escuche nuestra voz.
Mexico is going through a difficult time, and as a Mexican citizen living abroad, it's so important to have my voice heard, she says, especially since her mom and brother still live in Mexico City. Taub says she's particularly interested in what this new elected official can accomplish.
Somos un país con muchísima, muchísima cultura.
Taub says she wants her European friends to see the beauty of Mexico City and Mexico overall, beyond headlines about organized crime and poverty. Perhaps the new representative could help create a more positive image, she says. Other voters want more government funding for programs that help Mexicans abroad return home, including people who've been deported and can find it tough to restart life in Mexico. Israel Concha is an immigrant rights activist. He's sent in his ballot from Los Angeles.
So many people struggling, especially deportees, dreamers. Many people lost scholarships.
Concha was undocumented growing up in the U.S., then deported to Mexico as an adult. A few years ago, he won his immigration case and was allowed to return. During his time in Mexico City, Concha started a nonprofit to help deportees, migrants, and binational families, people like him. But the Mexican government hasn't given them much support, he says.
So it was just us, this community helping one another. That's how we've been able to survive.
He hopes a new representative will focus more on migrant issues. Concha says once his visa expires in about a year, he'll return to Mexico City. And he'll follow up with a newly elected official to see what's being accomplished.
We are hopeful, and we're going to be there every step of the way, making sure they do their job.
For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Let's return to the case of Roman Protasevich. Protasevich, the Belarusian dissident who was recently arrested by Belarusian authorities. He's accused of organizing unsanctioned protests against strongman leader Alexander Lukashenko. Yesterday, Protasevich appeared in an interview on Belarusian state TV where, likely under duress, he confessed to these crimes. Olga Drindova is a Belarus analyst and a political scientist. She joins us from Berlin. Remind us, first of all, who is Roman Protasevich?
Well, Roman Protasevich was editor of one of the most, or even I would say most successful Telegram channels named Nekhta last year. It was the Telegram channel that actually managed to mobilize Belarusians for all those big street actions with hundreds of thousands of people on the street that we observed last year. And it was quite successful. And actually, for the first time in Belarusian history, that something like that happened.
And more recently, Olga, how did Roman Protasevich end up back in Belarus?
Yes, unfortunately for him, I mean, it was never his intention. So that was a European flight from Greece to Lithuania. And, well, the plane he was inside was forced by the Belarusian security forces to land in Belarus. And he was arrested in the airport together with his girlfriend.
So, Olga, what was your reaction when you saw this ostensible interview yesterday, when you saw Roman confessing supposedly to these alleged crimes?
Well, I mean, it was really emotionally hard to hear Roman. The interview lasted about 1.5 hours. And all this kind of self-denunciation that he made and also discrediting his former colleagues. Of course, we do understand under which conditions he made that. We do understand that he's been communicating, so to say, with the security forces in Belarus for 1 week already. And we know that Belarusian KGB, they are really good trained to break people, like both physically and mentally. And that's actually what happened yesterday. I mean, in case of Roman, we understand that his girlfriend is in prison. And of course, we do understand that we still have death penalty in Belarus, so he can theoretically also be killed by the Belarusian state. So of course, when you have this choice, you most probably would choose to speak in public, and just the way he did.
Aside from what he said, how did Protasevich appear? Do you have a sense of how he's treated while he's in detention?
Well, unfortunately, well, we don't know how he's treated. I mean, during the interview, he said that he's quite okay. But I mean, of course, we do understand that most probably it's not true. I mean, you can at least, you can see at some moments during this interview that there are some traces of torture or maybe some physical damage on his hands. And it's quite clear to see. Also, I mean, those messages that are coming from state media in Belarus, the first one, the West is financing and coordinating the opposition, and the second one is the opposition is not united and they will never manage to get people back in the streets. So those two messages were the main messages in this interview of Protasevich yesterday. Mm,
and those were things that Protasevich was saying himself?
Yes, he was saying himself, and he even cried. I can just imagine that he's just broken physically and mentally, and he's just trying to save his life and apparently the life of his girlfriend and maybe also of his family and friends.
Right. I mean, Roman Protasevich is not the only political prisoner in Belarus. There are many other opposition leaders. They've been in prison for months now. Is there anything the EU or the US could do to kind of ensure their backs?
Yes, you're quite right. There are almost 500 political prisoners. We already have the first reactions, both from the European and from the United States. We have the U.S. sanctions against the oil production industry that are back. We'll see if the same or similar sanctions will come also from the European Union. We're expecting a decision on sanctions at the end of June. And there are some first very hard reactions from the European Union. I mean, this ban for Belarusian airlines to fly over the European Union, and also there is a recommendation not to use Belarusian airspace for the European flights. And of course, European Union also has other instruments to help people, helping civil society, independent media, and also people who try to leave the country, which is quite difficult now because of the air ban. So those who want to leave the country out of political reasons, who are scared about the life and security, do not have many options. So it's a kind of a very difficult decision, I think.
Olga Drindova, a Berlin-based Belarus analyst and political scientist, speaking with us about the case of Roman Protasevich. Thank you very much, Olga.
Thank you.
Climate change is not a future problem. It's affecting people's lives right now. In Nigeria, it's led to conflict between farmers and cattle herders, specifically the herders of the Fulani ethnic group, in part because water is scarce and the land has become less productive. Oriye Ogunbiyi tells a story to the Intelligence Podcast from our partners at The Economist.
For centuries, the Fulani nomads have herded cattle across West Africa, traveling along these established routes from Nigeria to Mali. The Fulani people make up around 6% of Nigeria's population, which is quite a significant minority, but they spread really far across the Sahel. They're often incorrectly grouped with the Hausa, which is Nigeria's largest ethnic group, because they have a really long history of migration into Hausa land, so much so that the Hausa and Fulani languages have become almost mutually intelligible. About a third of the Fulani people, not all of them, are nomadic herders. And settled grazing has become more popular since the 20th century, but many Fulani are still nomadic, moving their cattle wherever the most favourable weather conditions are. Their way of life is becoming a little bit harder. There's a growing population in Nigeria, and that's put them in increasing conflicts with the people who live along the traditional Fulani routes. And in addition, climate change has reduced the amount of water available and has diverted the Fulani herders from their northerly routes down to the agricultural heartlands towards the south of Nigeria.
Ogunbiyi says that when villagers try and turn nomadic herders away from those farmlands, violent altercations can be common.
So cattle rustling, which is a traditional Fulani practice, adds to that volatility. Raids and reprisals sometimes lead to villages or nomadic encampments being burned and herders or farmers killed.
She says the Nigerian government has concluded that migratory grazing is no longer viable. There's a program now to help Fulani herders establish ranches. It's hoped that will also forge business relationships between the herders and farmers. But so far, no new ranches have been built in the 2 years since the plan was launched. As a result, local governments have started to ban all grazing on public land. The economist Oriye Ogunbiyi says that's a prescription for more conflict.
I mean, yeah, the problems are multiplying. Benue State, for example, where the issue is particularly acute, is known as Nigeria's food basket. And widespread conflict there could threaten food security for the whole country. The instability has also been hijacked by other troublemakers, adding to the complexity. Although violence is typically blamed on Fulani herders, it's clear that Boko Haram and perhaps other criminal groups are exploiting the upheaval. So I think what we're seeing is a traditional Fulani practice becoming a lot more complex and threatening the security of the whole region.
Oriye Ogunbiyi writes about foreign affairs for The Economist. She told this story to the Intelligence Podcast from Economist Radio. You can hear more by looking for Economist Radio wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to The World. A new perspective on the tragedy that was the Titanic from the point of view of the Chinese sailors who survived.
There's a feeling that if you survived, that meant that someone died because you took their space in a lifeboat, and that's simply not the case.
What actually happened to the Chinese survivors? A fresh take on the most famous shipwreck in history. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The COVID-19 pandemic has turned the world upside down in so many ways, and yet it's not over by a long shot. We want to reflect on another ongoing pandemic that began a few decades ago. Here's a voice from the time that will sound familiar.
The transmissibility might occur prior to the time that an individual develops one of these infections and is thereby classified as having AIDS.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci in 1984. Tomorrow, June 5th, marks the 40th anniversary of the outbreak of the HIV-AIDS crisis and the first report from the Centers for Disease Control about the epidemic. Since then, 32 million people have lost their lives to the disease. In the late 1990s, new antiretroviral treatments offered hope, saving millions of lives around the world. Edwin Cameron is one of those people. He's a former justice with the Constitutional Court of South Africa, and he's considered a pioneer in the movement to fight HIV/AIDS in South Africa. That's where he joins us from. Edwin, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you, Marco. Thank you.
Can you tell us how it feels to mark this anniversary, first of all? What are you feeling 4 decades since the outbreak of HIV/AIDS?
I'm feeling a lot of intense and mixed feelings. I was a young man, still under 30, about to come out as queer in 1981, and I did the next year. And I was terrified with so many other gay men. I acquired HIV myself, and I entered a terribly dark period because one of the distinguishing features of this disease has been the stigma. So the anniversary holds intense feelings for me 40 years back. And then, of course, a sense of great humility, not a clamant joy, but a humble appreciation for the privileges that have meant that I'm still alive and able to talk with you today.
Talk about what was going on in South Africa. I mean, South Africa was pretty quickly impacted, along with Uganda, notably. What were the conversations like in South Africa?
So the overwhelmingly heterosexual shape of the epidemic in Africa only became apparent a bit later. In Uganda, as you rightly say, the empty villages syndrome in the mid-1980s, and then in South Africa, with the onset of democracy after 1984, with the Mandela presidency. So there were complex political issues. AIDS was a highly political disease. AIDS revolutionized our approach to treatment, to activism, to doctor-patient relationships. It revolutionized our approach to marginalized groups like people like myself, queer men, sex workers, other marginalized groups, people using drugs. So we mustn't talk only in funereal, solemn, grieving terms about the epidemic. We have to recognize that deep within that rightfully funereal feeling about the epidemic, there were also acts of extraordinary courage.
When the antiretroviral drugs were introduced into the market, Edwin, what changed? Also, what did not change?
What has not changed, to start with your second question, Marco, is the lingering shame, the lingering stigma. I think it's to do with the fact that it's a sexually transmitted disease. That has not changed as much as I thought it would. And what did change was the drugs. They stop the virus in its tracks. It is remarkable. It is near miraculous. And it isn't miraculous, of course. One must remember that this was a medical breakthrough, largely paid for, Marco, by public money in North America. Many of the key drugs were developed by your National Institute of Health, by the CDC, by the University, I think, of Virginia. I might be getting it wrong here, by other universities. And then the patent holders got hold of them and took them and said, we're not going to make them available in Africa.
I was going to ask you, it was miraculous, but what did you feel, Edwin, when you realized most people would not be able to afford these life-saving drugs?
I felt an impelling sense of urgency to join the struggle to make the drugs available to everyone. Of course, at that point in Africa, there were 30 to 40 million people who faced death, a terrible lingering death. And we could not let that happen. Zaki Ahmed could not let that happen. And his confederates in the treatment action campaign, they confronted the drug companies. And eventually, with the assistance of the Clinton and Gates foundations in 2002, the pharma companies backed off.
I'm speaking with South African lawyer Edwin Cameron, who has spent many years of his life speaking out as an HIV/AIDS activist. You know, I think about the timeline of COVID. We went from knowing virtually nothing about it to having, in under a year, several effective vaccines. I think about HIV, a year after the CDC's report came out on June 5th, 1981, about the pandemic, there still wasn't a name for the virus. People were using GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. What is the biggest, most important lesson from the HIV/AIDS pandemic that you can pass on to advocates and activists on today's COVID-19 pandemic?
So we transform public policy by enraged, contained, savvy, strategic, well-directed, principled activism. That's what got us the treatments with AIDS. It's what got us the breakthrough, which was a treatment breakthrough rather than a chemical or scientific or laboratory breakthrough. So I think that's the most important thing. And it's a lesson not just for disease or for the doctor-patient relationship or for the epidemiological relationship with the pharma companies. It's a lesson for our lives. It's a lesson for young people in the United States and in Africa that by activist interventions can change our world.
And briefly, what should the rage about COVID be?
There's good cause for rage. I'm an African, I'm a white African, I'm a South African. I'm 68 years old. I've not yet been vaccinated. But the rage should be directed at the fact that we do not see this as a worldwide calamity. Canada hoarding vaccines, Western Europe hoarding vaccines. It is shameful. It is wrong. And it is, of course, like so many unprincipled and unjust things in public health. It's also a very bad public health. Send Africa your vaccines and you will protect yourselves. Don't vaccinate your kids and teenagers before everyone in Africa and South Asia and the rest of the world has been vaccinated. That's what we should be feeling rage about now.
Edwin Cameron is a pioneer in the movement to fight HIV/AIDS in South Africa. Edwin, thank you very much for reflecting on the past 40 years with us.
What a joy. Thank you, Marco.
If you've ever had to flee your home country and seek asylum in the U.S., you know the process can be long and complicated. The Biden administration wants things moving faster at the U.S.-Mexico border. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, looked into what changes could mean for asylum seekers. She begins her report speaking with Santiago, a father from Mexico, now in the U.S. with his son. We're only using Santiago's first name because his status in the U.S. is uncertain.
April 12th, that's when Santiago crossed the border at Arizona with his 10-year-old son. They'd left their home in the Mexican state of Jalisco, in an area where powerful criminal groups are battling for turf. Santiago tells me about a recent mass shooting near his home.
Hubieron 11 muertos, hubieron 12 heridos.
Eleven people were gunned down in the street. Then one of Santiago's relatives was killed, he says. He left Mexico with his son, with the plan that his wife and two other kids would follow. Now, the father and son are with relatives near Detroit. They're slowly getting their bearings. Santiago has found work landscaping and a summer school for his son. Before they were released at the border, Santiago was given a court date. Over the phone, he also shows me his ankle.
Me pusieron el grillete. En este momento, lo único que hago es esperar mi primera corte.
It's a bulky black GPS tracking device that border agents put on him and a reminder of the pressure he faces to win asylum in the U.S. It's a process that can take years. And now the Biden administration is trying to change that by fast-tracking asylum cases for people who arrive at the border. Courts in 10 cities will take up the cases, including L.A., San Francisco, and New York. Alejandro Mayorkas, the head of Homeland Security, says the quicker cases will be decided in a, quote, orderly, efficient, and fair manner. How much faster? Generally, judges will have to decide cases within 300 days of the first hearing. Some say that's a tough timeline.
It can take a case 3 to 4 years to work its way through our court system.
Donna Lee Marks is with the National Association of Immigration Judges. She says these cases are complicated and the stakes are high. She also sees many asylum seekers facing the court alone.
The individuals who come before us don't have the right to appointed counsel. And yet, if they lose their case, they may be being sent back to a situation where their lives are at risk.
The Trump and Obama administrations tried these faster systems before when there's been more migrants at the border. Homeland Security officials argue that these programs can help keep new cases from adding to a massive backlog. But even when cases are sped up, the backlog has grown steadily over the years. Charlene DeCruz is an immigration lawyer in Brownsville, Texas. She wishes the focus was more on helping asylum seekers navigate the immigration system and organize a case. Even just collecting basic documents is a challenge.
Some of them are walking around with birth certificates that are frayed because in some of these countries, it is impossible to keep getting new birth certificates. Some of them don't even have a government that's functional, right? So if we're going to get all of this proof that is necessary for asylum, 300 days doesn't sound like a lot to me.
Santiago and his son entered the U.S. before the new expedited process took hold this month. He's glad he's not facing a tight timeline. He struggled to find a lawyer.
Varios me denegaron, me dijeron que no, que esos casos son muy pesados y que no los tomaban por esa situación.
Several lawyers turned me down, he says. They say I have a tough case, and it's true. Santiago's reason for seeking asylum is because organized crime in his Mexican neighborhood is making his family's life unsafe, he says. But the Trump administration ruled that gang violence is not a reason for asylum. The Biden administration is now reviewing those rulings, though, says Yael Shaher with Refugees International, a nonprofit based in D.C.
Look, many of these families may be in luck. Maybe they made the right decision. Maybe the change is going to come. We could have movement on eligibility. We could. The question is, it's a little bit of a risk right now.
Santiago is betting on that change and says he wants to make his case.
Mientras exista, así sea el 1%, puedo llegar a ser ese 1%.
Even if I have a 1% chance of winning, I have to do it, he says. I need to stay positive. But nearly 2 months on in the U.S., Santiago has only managed to pay a lawyer $100 for an initial meeting. He hopes she'll stick with him so that he doesn't face his first court appearance alone. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
Everybody knows the story of the Titanic, but a century now since it sunk, don't think that everything about the deadly passage has been told. From Shanghai, Rebecca Canther reports on a new documentary that puts the disaster in a whole new light.
In China, the story of the Titanic is well known. Well, at least the fictional version with Rose and Jack. What's less well known? The fact that there were 8 Chinese passengers on the real Titanic, and 6 of them survived. Their story has never been told, till now. A recently released film called The Six explores their stories and what happened to them after they survived the most famous shipwreck in history.
Ali Lam, Fong Long, Len Lam.
They were professional sailors, traveling third class on the Titanic to get to another job. Their names were recorded in the ship's passenger log, but that's all that the filmmakers had to go on. That and some damning American news reports from the time.
They were kind of invisible right up until the moment that they got scapegoated for, you know, what was viewed as or labeled as ignoble behavior, which was surviving.
Stephen Schrankert is a maritime researcher who worked on the documentary.
There's a feeling that if you survived, that meant that someone died because you took their space in a lifeboat. And that's simply not the case.
5 of the men escaped in lifeboats. News reports accused them of hiding under the seats and pretending to be women to get on board. Schwenkert says that his team's research showed this wasn't true.
And it showed that they weren't cowards and that they didn't toss anyone overboard to save their own lives. It was an opportunity and they took it.
The last Chinese survivor, Fong Long, was found clinging to a piece of wood floating in the ocean. His story was almost immortalized in the 1997 Titanic film.
Can anyone hear me?
This scene shows a crew member in a lifeboat returning to find a Chinese man floating on a door in the freezing water. He's surrounded by dead bodies.
Put your box into it!
Titanic director James Cameron wound up cutting the scene. But Fong Long's story inspired the film's big finale, where Jack has drowned and Rose survives alone on a wooden board. As for the Chinese survivors from the real Titanic, life didn't get easier. When the rescue ship docked in New York, they weren't allowed on shore. In 1912, the Chinese Exclusion Act was still in effect, and it barred Chinese laborers from entering the U.S. The Chinese survivors were detained on board and then transferred to another boat that took them to Cuba. Arthur Jones directed The Six. He says America's racist policies have had a long-term effect on the descendants of Chinese immigrants from that time.
I think we discovered that this was not just a story about a piece of metal that went down, but it actually has a kind of tangible effect on people who are still alive now, you know, whose backgrounds have been sort of riven, have been broken apart.
The six men never felt safe sharing their harrowing stories. They worked on ships in the Caribbean and then the UK, until they were forced to leave that country because of anti-immigrant policies. The men scattered around the world, to India, Hong Kong, Canada, and the US. Fong Long, the man who survived by floating on a door, immigrated to Milwaukee with a new name, Fong Ling Sun. He never told his wife and son, Tom, about his past. Tom, who's featured in The Six, only learned of it from a cousin after his father died.
This is the photo I think about the time when he just, on the Titanic. I asked my mother, did she know? She said she never heard about it. She never heard about my father being in this boat and sinking or anything.
The documentary team, more than half of whom were Chinese, were struck by the connection between the recent spike in anti-Asian hate crimes around the world and what the six Titanic survivors endured. Here is Stephen Schwenkert again.
It shows that these are not new problems. The bad news there is that they're probably not problems that are going to go away very quickly. By having a greater understanding of where the problems come from, then hopefully we can find better solutions for them.
What becomes clear is that these men survived much more than a shipwreck.
And they just kind of went on with their lives. And, you know, it was just one more thing they had to face, but they never backed down. They just kept going.
The Six is slated for a global release soon. And Schwenkert is working on a Chinese language book to go along with the film. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Catholic Cardinal Reinhard Marx, Archbishop of Munich and Freising, has offered to resign. The reason is appallingly familiar. The cardinal cited the Catholic Church's mishandling of sexual abuse cases. Read more on the story in our newsletter. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. This week, Puerto Ricans turned on their lights and began getting their electricity from a private, not a public utility. The Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, or PREPA, has taken a lot of blowback in recent years for literally leaving residents in the dark for nearly 12 months after hurricanes struck the island. PREPA had also declared bankruptcy. Enter Luma Energy and a 15-year contract to manage Puerto Rico's grid. Joining me now is Cecilio Ortiz-Garcia. He's a political scientist at the University of Puerto Rico at Mayagüez. He specializes in energy and governance. This week, it wasn't really the smoothest transition from public to private. Some customers were without electricity again. There were also calls for strikes against the privatization plan. What has been the overall response to this change from residents of Puerto Rico?
It would depend. But in general, there has been the recognition that what was sold as a normal privatization process really glossed over its complexity, which is a contract that is coming to replace a public monopoly with a private monopoly, that it's coming to do so under a current decay of our public administration in the island. And that leaves very little amounts of trust that such a change is going to actually deliver on the promise of a more resilient energy system, and even worse, that it might even hinder our capacity to transition to a renewable future.
I'm struck by your description of PREPA, the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, as a public monopoly. What are your own criticisms of PREPA?
Well, my colleagues and I have really looked at the historical transition of the energy landscape of Puerto Rico, and PREPA certainly has been encrypted in our history as one of the greatest policy accomplishments in the modernization of the island. Back in the 1940s, PREPA was being touted as a mini Tennessee Valley Authority, as a model that was followed in the island to electrify even the most remote parts of our countryside. For years, the narratives that described PREPA were those of innovation, public service, and unfortunately, that model of public agency really found itself without a new mission once it accomplished its first mission of electrifying Puerto Rico.
So are you saying, Cecilio, that PREPA was basically unable to evolve over time and got overtaken by corruption?
Quite correct. We have high levels of consumption in the island. And once PREPA was infused with political appointments, it started using monies that were supposed to go to maintaining the grid in good standing so that it could be able to withstand the increase in climate-related events. Those monies were actually used as a little bank account for political parties in the island.
Professor, you mentioned the weak political status of Puerto Rico. Does the ceding of the island's power grid to a private entity for 15 years, has that renewed calls for statehood?
It is a mixed bag. On the one hand, those who are looking for the statehood are using the current situation to exemplify how we are still second-rate citizens. At the same time, globally, Puerto Rico is a canary in the mine in terms of climate change and how Puerto Rico is looked at as a litmus test for the decarbonization of the planet. And I think this contract has found fertile ground in that very wicked landscape of energy policy in Puerto Rico at this moment. Unfortunately, it's leaving behind the claims of justice for people like the electrical workers of PREPA that are now left in limbo, and the people that actually suffered after Maria from that total blackout. Really, there is no certainty that their system is going to be more robust in facing another event like Maria in the future.
Cecilio Ortiz Garcia, a political science professor at the University of Puerto Rico in Mayagüez. He specializes in energy and governance. Professor Ortiz, thank you for unpacking this for us.
Thank you.
Okay, this next item is for you basketball fans out there, or fans of Central European culture. Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
The Dallas Mavericks play tonight against the Los Angeles Clippers in the NBA playoffs. Rooting hard for the Mavs, their new mascot.
I'm finally back! For the kids who don't know me, I'm Mavrelo Belovic, owner of Mavs.
Mavrelo Belovic is a cartoon character with a somewhat bizarre backstory.
I've been buried under the Reunion Arena since 1988. I was digging myself out using only concession stand sports.
Belovic claims he's the rightful owner of the Mavericks. And now, after 33 years, he's back and has some innovative ideas for the Dallas franchise.
We make court out of glass. It is see-through, so we sit more people underneath the court. VIP people, we make very expensive.
Just to be clear, none of this is based in reality. Belovic is a cartoon character with a basketball head, a scruffy 5 o'clock shadow, gold-capped front tooth, winter hat with ear flaps, and he wears a foam number one finger. Belovic is the brainchild of the Mavericks owner.
Hey guys, Mark Cuban here.
Cuban is known for pushing the envelope. He appears in another online video discovering the existence of this new cartoon mascot, setting up the plot of who is the rightful owner of the team.
Tour of the arena. What the this? What are you? Who are you?
I'm Mavrelo Belovic, owner of Mavericks. And you are?
I'm Mark Cuban.
The new mascot may seem right on the edge of being an offensive stereotype of Central or Eastern Europeans. It's not meant to be. The Mavs are stacked with stars from that region, including Luka Doncic from Slovenia, one of the NBA's best young players. The Mavericks started recruiting from that part of the world a long time ago. Dirk Nowitzki from Germany, considered the greatest European ever to play in the NBA, logged 21 seasons with the Mavs. He retired 2 years ago, and is now apparently palling around with Mavrelo Belovic. In this online video, Belovic asked Nowitzki for advice on how to deal with the boss.
Back when I was playing, Mark and I would discuss things like...
You play for Mavs?
You didn't know that?
No, but we'll Google you. Anyway, continue.
The new mascot may be pretty out there, but owner Mark Cuban says it's all about attracting eyeballs and pushing past traditional boundaries. And who knows, some of Mavrelo Belovic's out there ideas might just catch on to make NBA games more enjoyable.
Anybody ask Mavrelo, say it was Dirk's idea.
What? No.
For the world, I'm Jason Margolis.
How about a glass roof so you can look right down on the court? Yeah, Belovic has got me thinking. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston at GBH. We're taking the weekend off. You have a good one yourselves. We'll see you back here on Monday. From PRX.